Hi, you're listening to What's the Deal, our investment banking series here on JP Morgan's Making Sense podcast channel. I'm your host today, Evan Junik from the Corporate Finance Advisory Team. And today I'm joined by my colleague, Arslan Matafar, our new head of development financed institutions at JP Morgan, also known as JP Morgan DFI or JPM DFI for short. We are diving into the takeaways from the latest annual DFI report and the progress on the Industry First Impact Disclosure Task Force. Arslan, welcome to the podcast today.
Thank you for having me, Evan. Pleasure to be here.
Well, let's just jump right into it. Could you maybe just briefly introduce yourself and share your journey at JP Morgan leading up to becoming the head of the JP Morgan DFI?
So I was born and I grew up in Iran. And growing up in a developing country, you see up close the development challenges that people in these countries deal with on a day-to-day basis. Often they struggle to meet some of the basic human needs on health and education and infrastructure. So I came with that background to the United States for university. And upon graduation, I started to work in management consulting with a focus on international development. I worked a bit in Sub-Saharan Africa and in the Middle East on a lot of the development challenges that countries face and help governments with national development plans and industrial policy. I then came to JP Morgan in 2017 in the strategy team to advise JP Morgan's senior management on growth and transformation strategies for the bank. And one of the strategies I worked on in 2019 was the strategy to launch a development finance institution at JP Morgan. We launched the JP Morgan DFI in 2020. We brought Faheen Alipoy from the IFC to head the team, and I joined her as her deputy to establish the team and to grow our business. And then in 2023, Faheen moved to a different role in the bank, and I took over as head of the JP Morgan DFI.
Well, that's terrific. I mean, it really sounds like you've got a unique background to address and focus on this unique role. Let's talk a little bit about this annual report that your team publishes that really highlights the DFI's developments and accomplishments. Can you walk us through some key highlights from this year's report compared to last year?
We had actually a pretty good year in 2023. I think generally the economy has stabilized. A lot of the recession that people predicted didn't happen. Supply chains normalized. We saw that a lot of the bottlenecks that were happening in the supply chains got declogged. And as companies started to diversify, they started to shift their manufacturing into other markets. And that actually was a boost for the growth. Consumer spending was quite robust. So that allowed us to assess about $150 billion of transactions as having anticipated development impact. So having a development impact thesis, that's about a 15% growth from last year. We also served as a development finance structuring agent for 19 transactions in 2023, compared to 13 transactions, which we did in 2022. Being a development finance structuring agent means that we are involved when the transaction is being executed to bring the development impact thesis and crowd in additional impact-focused investors. So that's another 40% growth there. And I think one of the key highlights from 2023 was that we hit a milestone with the Impact Disclosure Task Force. This is a task force we launched in April 2023, but we released a concept note in November during COP28 and got a lot of traction with the group that have come around to create an industry standard around impact for the SDGs.
Oh, that's great. And obviously a lot of progress when you're talking about both more volume in terms of dollars and more volume and velocity in terms of overall deals that you guys are involved with. Another aspect of development finance is measuring impact. So maybe you could talk a little bit on the kinds of methodologies that you might employ and that we here at JP Morgan use to assess the impact of those transactions.
Yeah, Evan, that's really important because we fall under the broader umbrella of ESG and sustainability, but there's a big and crucial difference between what we do and that more umbrella term. If you think about ESG and how it has evolved over time, ESG was first created as a risk management tool. Investors said, how much is my company exposed to environmental and social and governance risks? For instance, do I have facilities that are by the ocean and might be damaged by rising ocean levels and climate change? Do I have governance issues that might create reputational problems running my company? So it was a bit of a different idea than actually what was often an investor's mind, that when I put my money in ESG, I am helping to change the world and make the world a better place. That's probably the definition of impact. Impact is about change. It's about taking something from where it is and making it better. And specifically, development impact means helping improve the quality of life of people in developing countries and helping them address their basic human needs on health, education, infrastructure. So when we wanted to create an impact methodology and one that is focused on development impact, we didn't create this from scratch. We went to the official sector development institutions, the likes of the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank. They have been doing this for decades. And we went and learned their methodologies and then thought to bring that back to JP Morgan. But we're a different institution than those institutions. We have a lot more products. We are operating in capital markets. We're operating with private investors. So we tailored our methodology to fit our business model and be relevant to the investors that we work with. And that is the methodology that we've created, which is available on our website, but essentially works by identifying what the development challenges are and creating a framework for measuring the outputs and outcomes that a company or a government can produce that ultimately addresses society-level development gaps and challenges in that country.
Very interesting. So the report also showcases various specific transactions that presumably are all part of both the numbers you just talked about as well as were assessed through the methodology that you just referred to. What is that one noteworthy achievement you wanted to spotlight from the report?
One transaction I'm particularly proud of was for a company in Brazil called Motu. This company has a really interesting and innovative business model. They manufacture motorcycles, which then they lease to couriers that use them to deliver packages and food and things through these various courier apps. But these motorcycles are leased to folks that often can't afford to go and buy their own motorcycle and therefore usually don't have a job or are in the informal sector of the economy. Motu wanted to expand its operations, build 20,000 additional motorcycles that not only would create 6,000 good manufacturing jobs in Brazil in its own factories, but ultimately create 20,000 courier jobs for those that they would lease these motorcycles to. I mean, this is obviously has a lot of economic impact, but it also had a lot of sustainability built in it as well. The motorcycles that they manufactured had lower emissions than the average motorcycles on the streets of Brazil. So they were net positive for increasing the sustainability of the fleet in the market. They also invested a lot in training, providing schools for their engineers and their mechanics in the facilities to be upskilled to be able to manufacture these higher tech motorcycles. They had a lot of principles of circular economy baked into their business model to ensure that they're recycling a lot of the metal scraps, the oil, the tires, so that they reduce their material waste. And that's actually a big issue in Brazil. Brazil is in the top quartile of producing municipal waste per capita in their cities. So having a target on ensuring that they're building these motorcycles in an environmentally sustainable way was very important.
Us as the financial institution, is this just a proposal that they come to us with? Are there incentives that they have to meet or objectives that, in this case, the motorcycle company needs to meet over time to ensure that the things that they've said they've done are achieved? Obviously, if you talk about the corporate landscape here in the United States, there's a whole host of different structures which would say, here are the key performance indicators with respect to sustainable objectives, and you have to meet these if you want to achieve the best pricing, as a simple example. Is that something similar that's part of this kind of investment opportunity, or is it a little bit more, here's the proposal and we're participating or helping to facilitate the financing of that kind of opportunity?
So there's some similarities and there's some differences. If we start from just plain vanilla financing, an investor might finance a company like Motu purely on risk return criteria. If the company is creditworthy and they have a solid revenue path and you can lend them money and you're confident you'll get that money back with interest, they're financeable and they'll be financed. And that's done by, I would say, mainstream financing, right? Then you have sustainable finance, which will probably come and say, look, I'm going to look at a few criteria, certain KPIs, and I want you to ensure that you hit those KPIs in order to be eligible for my sustainable pockets of financing. And then you have development finance. And the difference of development finance is that the sustainability criteria that you are defining have development materiality. For instance, Brazil has very high unemployment. So creating jobs in Brazil has much more development impact than if you were creating jobs in an economy that has a tight labor market, right? The reason that we take a look at the KPI for reducing solid waste was because that there was a development gap in solid waste production. If this company happened to be in a jurisdiction which their landfills weren't bursting with waste, then it would have been less of a focus of the KPI that they need to manage for. So identifying the set of sustainability metrics that have development materiality is at core of what our group does. And to answer your question, we would work with the company to identify what are those metrics that have development materiality, help them set baselines, targets, and a framework for ongoing monitoring and reporting so that their progress on meeting those objectives becomes transparent. And when you create that transparency, then you're able to attract certain pockets and sources of capital that would otherwise not be available to them.
It sounds like that's an important distinction here, right? Which is this is not just a financing exercise. This is very much an advisory exercise whereby you're working with clients and companies to maximize their exposure to these pockets of capital. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And that's the role we take when we get assigned as a development finance structuring agent. It's in many ways helping them structure the set of impact metrics that they need to monitor and manage for in order to be able to attract those type of investors. And then we also really help with that investor marketing as well to identify the investors that care about this stuff and ensure that we're attracting them to these type of deals.
So I think that example just exemplifies how important the methodology is that you're talking about here. And I know we discussed the Impact Disclosure Task Force, which obviously ties into a lot of, by definition, the disclosure there. And you mentioned Faheen earlier. We talked to Faheen about it last year on how it can advance some of that reporting and those reporting trends. Can you give a quick overview on what exactly that Impact Disclosure Task Force is for new listeners and maybe provide an update on the task force's progress?
So the task force is really trying to help rewire some of the plumbing of sustainable finance in order to direct capital to where it's needed most. So to unpack that, let me just lay the landscape of what we're dealing with. The amount of capital that currently has some measure of ESG integrated in it is as large as $40 trillion. That's the latest estimates. Now, that volume of capital, the way that it's currently allocated is that they look at certain metrics of environmental and social and governance, as we discussed earlier, and they weight their portfolio towards companies that have better scores on those factors. Today, the companies and entities that have higher ESG scores are usually based in developed markets because they're more mature and they're more advanced on those factors. So most of that $40 trillion is going to developed markets. Now, if we look at the agenda for the Sustainable Development Goals, the biggest gaps are in emerging markets. So what we're trying to do with this task force is to first shift the focus from ESG to impact. Impact is not about just where you are, but it's also where you want to be and how you're going to make change. And so we're helping companies disclose their forward-looking intentions to improve themselves on measures of environmental, social, and governance, and ultimately socioeconomic outputs and outcomes that address these SDG gaps. So that's the first kind of fundamental component of the task force. The second is then to create a data platform where all this information could be aggregated. Because Wall Street moves very fast and people are looking at their Bloomberg screen and reacting to signals and flashing lights, and they might not have enough time to read a 30-page PDF report around certain things. So in order to make sure that this information is consumed and is integrated into investment allocation decisions, we need to digitize that information and we need to disseminate that scale. So that's the second goal of the task force, to create that impact data platform. And then the third is to create a suite of ancillary services that will support creating trust by enhancing the veracity of the data that is in this platform. So we're talking about independent verification. We're talking about monitoring and evaluation. We're talking about analytics, indices that will help aggregate this information and package it in a way that becomes investable or becomes a benchmark. We're talking about technical assistance that will help companies that need support in order to be able to publish this information to be published. So all of those ancillary services is needed in order to create really the ecosystem that will allow this to scale at the scale that is needed. Because achieving the SDGs requires around $6 trillion of capital per year between now and 2030. And currently, there's only about $2 trillion that is available. Most of it coming from official development institutions, public sector funded development banks like the World Bank and other development banks. About $0.7 trillion is coming from the private sector. But there's a $4 trillion annual investment gap. And really, everyone's calling for the private sector to come and fill that gap. Now, again, if you put that $4 trillion, the scale, or compared to the scale of the $40 trillion assets of under management that are ESG, it seems that it should be achievable. But again, it's not because of some of these gaps in the plumbing. And that's what we're trying to address with the task force.
Let's dig a little bit more into what that capital gap is in the emerging markets. It sounds like a big weapon in that battle is data, right? Just giving people the information in a standardized way, in a way that's accessible and to some extent verifiable and accurate, which sounds like a big part of the battle in making sure that some of that capital that has heretofore flown so easily into the developed countries also starts to diversify into developing countries as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm sure a lot of the listeners have heard about the discussions that a lot of investors have become hyper-cognizant and fearful of being ever accused of greenwashing. And so investors that manage sustainable funds want to be absolutely sure that the capital that they are allocating from those funds are going towards sustainable investments. And in many ways, they tell us, if there's no data, you don't get the capital. The data is the gatekeeper because they need that in order to prove or at least to confidently evidence that they are putting their capital to use in the right place. And that's the thing that is lacking in emerging markets, that data. And that's what we're trying to proliferate with this task force.
You talk a lot about impact in the more traditional corporate context. We would probably be talking about financial returns. Do you find that over time with the right data, with the right accuracy of that information, does impact create returns? Is that a fair connection to make, or is that still to be proven out?
I think a lot of people are looking at that question, and the thesis is that in the long term, impact does create returns because you're creating a more robust society that will probably grow economically better and more equitably and ultimately create better markets and better returns. That said, what we are heartened by seeing is that you have investors that are looking at this concept called double materiality. Single materiality or financial materiality means impact because it generates returns and there's a financial return to it. Double materiality means I'm looking at impact because I am seeking impact in of itself. It is a criteria for me as an investor. And we're seeing more and more investors that want to have impact in of itself. And the good thing is that they don't have to sacrifice returns because there are sufficient opportunities in the world that both generate market rate returns and generate positive impact. So for now, until we exhaust that, we don't even have to think about a trade-off. We just have to make sure that those opportunities that have that double bottom line are highlighted to the right people at the right place at the right time, and that investment is happening.
What's next? What's on the horizon for JP Morgan's DFI group? What's in the pipeline?
The next thing that we're really looking at is how do we really mainstream this across financial products? If you look at our annual report, we have done a lot of these impact frameworks together with bonds, with loans, some other banking products like letters of credit, trade finance facilities. What we also have seen a proof of concept in is in some of the markets products we have, like financial derivatives. Now, at a first glance, when people hear derivatives, they don't think impact. But derivatives ultimately help risk manage various risks for clients of ours. It could be interest rate risk. It could be foreign exchange risk. as an example, we had a client that was a financial intermediary in an African country, and they were on lending to SMEs and to farmers and to a lot of sectors that had positive impact in their country. But their lending happened in local currency. Their borrowing from the international markets happened in US dollars. And that was a constraint for them. We helped them execute a currency derivative that would hedge that foreign currency risk and allow them to borrow more from the international markets and ultimately on lend more to these developmental sectors. So putting this impact framework on that derivative allowed us to crowd in ESG capital into the frontier currency derivatives market. That was an innovation. And that's something we want to do more of across the financial products. And I think the task force we're also creating and participating in is really helping scale that up. So my message for the listeners is to think about impact more broadly and how it could be further applied across the sector. Ultimately, every company, whatever sector they're working in, has impact. The question is, do they want to measure it? Do they want to be mindful about it? Measure both the positive and the negative, try to increase the positive and reduce the negative, and do that consciously, and do that in a nuanced way. Because that's also one of the big differences that we're trying to push for. Don't just look at whether something fits in this box or the other box. Think about how you're making change. Sometimes it makes sense to invest in a sector that on the surface doesn't look good, but if you engage with it, you can help a transition to become good, and then you actually have impact versus just boycotting the sector and not looking at it at all. So my advice is for people to continue to push, but do that smartly and do that in a nuanced way.
Well, great. That's a perfect place to end. Arsalan, thank you so much for joining me today. I understand you'll be back on the show shortly to discuss evolving trends shaping development finance in APAC's emerging markets. It seems balancing climate change with economic growth is trickier in APAC, and with 60% of the world's population, APAC's progress on SDGs like climate action and poverty reduction will impact everybody. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another episode of What's the Deal, and we hope you enjoyed this conversation. Be sure to tune in to Arsalan's upcoming episode. I'm your host, Evan Junik, and until next time, goodbye.
Thank you, Evan. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to What's the Deal. If you've enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll review, rate, and subscribe to JP Morgan's Making Sense to stay on top of the latest industry news and trends. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and YouTube. To stay ahead of the curve, sign up for JP Morgan's In Context newsletter, packed full of market views and expert insights delivered straight to you. To subscribe, just visit jpmorgan.com/in-context. This material was prepared by the investment banking group of JP Morgan Securities LLC and not the firm's research department. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended as an offer or solicitation for the purchase, sale, or tender of any financial instrument.